Additional funding for KPCW has been provided by Right at Home, 1745 Bonanza Drive, Furniture and Home Accessories Consignment. Gallery Mar, fresh contemporary art on Main Street, gallerymar.com. Park City Gynecology, Park City Metasthetics, Women's Healthcare, Age Management, 435-214-5335. Rally Interactive, makes apps, websites, and other digital products. Rallyinteractive.com, the corporation for public broadcasting and listeners like you.
Whole Foods Market proudly supports KPCW as the official provider of pastries, fresh squeezed juice, and other natural breakfast items for KPCW's Green Room during the Sundance Film Festival. Whole Foods is located in Kimball Junction off Highway 224, open 7 days a week. Whole Foods, from the gourmet to the everyday, organic groceries, prepared meals, party trays, sushi, and more.
It's 9:06, and you're listening to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, and joining me as my co-host today, I have one of KPCW's Friday film reviewers, Mark Harrington. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Leslie.
So how's Sundance gone for you this year?
Well, pretty great. You know, for me, I've got a two-year-old, so it's always a little challenge to get my normal cache of films in, but I got about a half dozen under my belt so far, and I push heavy on the second weekend, as I hope most locals do, because as access increases and you get the award winners Sunday, which is just a great program and a great way to get caught up. And so hopefully both our visitors and locals take advantage of the final few days here.
Okay. So tell me what you've seen and what you really
liked. I've been heavy on the premiere category. So really like Calvary, the second effort by John Michael McDonough, starring Brandon Gleeson, with another Irish tale. Kind of tells the story of a priest who gets threatened by one of his parishioners in confession, and then has to figure out whether the threat's real or not, and how that impacts his work and his relations with the rest of town. And it features the similar vein of heavy themes broken up by Irish humor that his first effort, The Guard, did so well. Mm-hmm. But this one's a lot heavier. It takes on efforts of or themes related to the abuse scandal in the Catholic Church head on, literally and figuratively. But great performances all around, and just truly, truly, I think, a great follow-up effort. Whiplash, the opening night film, of course, you've already heard a lot about, so I've heard,
but I haven't seen it, though. Yeah, so, tell me what you thought.
Well, you know, J.K. Simmons is such a great actor and brings such a dimension to any role he plays, in terms of obviously just his voice is so, you know, he gets from his, you know, insurance commercials to, you know, Oz or whatever role he's played. And in this one, he obviously plays an instructor at a music academy and takes on this prodigal drummer and drives him to greatness or not is the theme. And what does that entail? And so just great performances again and really impactful. Saw Frank, which I'd call more the quintessential Sundance film, you know, a quirky story about a band member, a singer, band leader who is so got his own issues that he's got to wear a ceramic bobblehead on his head the whole time, based loosely on a true story. And again, just with Maggie Gyllenhaal and Michael Fassbender, just a great cast that delivers spot-on performances that... And one of the best beginnings sequences of festival, one of my favorite things to always look for is you know, unique starts to film. And I think Super Troopers probably being one of my favorite first 5 minutes of film in terms of fall down laughter. And this one has a pretty innovative start to a film in terms of the origins of songs and following its lead character as he walks down a street and thinks up of lyrics as he passes literally everything on the street. And so it's a real neat opening sequence I encourage people to check out.
Hmm. Okay, the name of that one was what?
Frank.
Frank. Mm-hmm.
And then last night saw Fishing Without Nets, a dramatic film based on the Somali pirating. And it is fictional, however, based on the director's exhaustive research on the topic. Kind of gives, it's one of those what I call perspective films, ones that you, even though it's fictional, it's not that it goes to show that the people that are perpetrating the crimes are, it's not scapegoating them, but it puts their place in life in perspective. And so what you saw with immigration last year with perhaps who is, what was that, Denia Crystal, you know, was similar in terms of showing the life of someone that has to make choices that lead to often disastrous and violent results. And so this was from the villagers' perspective, that where the origins of the pirating kind of come from the conflict and the tribalism and the various layers of families. And because these are really kin-oriented gangs, if you will, that do this pirating. And the little-known story is that most of the victims are Filipino people on the ships. And at its height, there were as many as 500 at a time at any given moment that were held hostage and often don't, you know, come out of it. And that's, you know, you don't hear a lot about that side of it and who the true victims are. And certainly with the publicity about Captain Phillips in that film, that's a different story. But this one was a little bit more on the ground perspective. And I really like these kind of films because they're what Sundance is about, I think was one of the comments in the audience, in the sense of it's not going to have a huge audience probably worldwide, but it is a rare opportunity to get a glimpse of a perspective that you may not otherwise through some pretty good storytelling.
Right. Okay, well, let's bring in our first guest we've got coming up this hour, Sean Means. He's a Tribune, works for the Salt Lake Tribune as their film critic. We're also going to have Geralyn Dreyfus. She's the founder of the Utah Film Center and a co-founder of Impact Partners. Jeremiah Zager is the director, Lori Cheadle, the producer of Captivated, The Trials of Pamela Smart. And winding it all up is Sydney Freeland. She's the director of Drinktown's Finest. So stay tuned.
Homestead Resort is proud to support KPCW's Fun Friday. Winter Wonderland activities include sleigh rides, dog sledding, cross-country skiing, snowmobiling, and the geothermal crater. Simon's Restaurant is open nightly, serving home-style dinners. Homestead Resort in Midway, 435-654-1102 or homesteadresort.com.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits, from business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Contrary to popular belief, getting pregnant can be difficult. For some couples, it can be quite a challenge. The OBGYNs at Park City Specialty Clinic are there to help you find solutions for pregnancy on your terms. The appointment number is 435-658-7400. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher along with Mark Harrington. Well, Sean Means is the Tribune, the film critic for the Salt Lake Tribune. He started off Sundance 2014 moderating the opening press conference of this year's festival and hasn't stopped since. He joins us now in the studio. Good morning, and you're still standing.
I'm still here.
Yeah. So are you worn out or you're just about done?
I'm almost ready for this to be over, yeah.
So in terms of a film count, what have you got?
I'm at 29.
Oh.
Four more to go. So, yeah.
Just four?
Yep.
So you don't wait for the winners or anything because you've probably already seen
no,
them.
No, the goal every year is to see all 32 of the U.S. competition films. And with the last four documentaries I'm seeing today, and one, or three today and one tomorrow, I will hit that. And then I do film church on Sunday and then I go home.
Yeah. So what is it that you, I mean, you want just to watch? Because many of these films will never make it to, you know, a big theater, even into Salt Lake. So you're not necessarily doing reviews about them.
Well, I do write reviews on our website, sltrip.com, for everything I see.
Ah, okay.
The fact that some of these movies will not be seen again after Sundance, I mean, that's true, but the fact that we're reviewing them plays into that. And if, you know, a movie that might have limited commercial potential, if it gets good critical buzz, get good reviews, it might have a shot. And on the other side, there are ones that, you know, if you give them bad reviews, you will, you know, condemn them to the oblivion that they deserve. So
tell me where we find those
this
reviews.
This is on sltrib.com.
Okay.
And we have the Sundance. Just look for the Sundance Film Festival blog.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the dramatic highlights for you.
Okay. Good year for comedies this year, especially in the among the U.S. dramatic competition. My favorite of the whole bunch is The Skeleton Twins. Really funny and also really tender, brother sister story with Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig, who two actors who have had great chemistry, all those years of Saturday Night Live, and that they were able to translate that into a dramatic setting, I think was really powerful, really moving. But also it showed that Bill Hader, I think, is somebody to watch who's going to, I think, could have a bigger career than just comedies and so on. So that one, I also liked Dear White People. Very funny. Some of the best one-liners in the entire festival. A college campus story about race relations on a college campus. Some very funny and very pointed media criticism about black culture. I don't think Tyler Perry is going to like this movie very much because he gets rather slammed a couple times. I also liked, I'm trying to remember here.
I was going to say he was doing this with no notes and now he just had to look down.
Well, the other one I was forgetting was Happy Christmas, which is Joe Swanberg, who, the very prolific indie filmmaker, very, improvisational style. This one really is about a family couple with a new baby. Inviting the husband's sister in for the holidays, and the sister's played by Anna Kendrick, and it's about her, and she's kind of a screw up, and it's about the sort of relation between the sister and the wife, played by Melanie Lynskey, as two women who are both sort of trying to figure out their identities, one after a breakup and the other as a stay-at-home mom. Very funny and very sweet. There's some good dramas too. I mean, Whiplash, the opening night film, which I saw it a whole 8 days ago. It just seems like forever, but very, very beautifully shot and very very good two character piece about a ambitious young drummer and the instructor who basically terrorizes him. Those are really the best ones I've seen.
And you've written about those in a different context as well, in terms of with Bill Hader and Happy Christmas as well, in terms of opportunities for the stars to break out of their traditional roles.
Right.
And talk about that a little bit in terms of how you see, is that still an allure for today's actresses in terms of, hey, I make these other films to enable me to do the quiet film,
right,
like The Song with Anne Hathaway or whatever, or is it truly an ambition to grow as an actor and partake in something that is back to their roots, if you will?
Right. I think actors like, they like to work and they like to do things that are interesting and challenging. You get somebody like Mark Ruffalo, he signed a good contract to play the Incredible Hulk in the Avengers movies. So he's good to go as far as his, financial situation. But he wants, he'll want to find things that challenge him in a different level. And, he's been here before. He directed a movie that was here a couple years ago. He's here this year with Infinitely Polar Bear. And, it's a chance to, stretch the muscles that you don't get to do when you're, sitting in a harness doing, CG, green screen moves. He joked about that. He said that this bipolar character he plays in Infinitely Polar Bear is, the low budget indie version of the Hulk, which is, would you think about it, it's kind of true. He's sort of the manic depressive aspect of his character. Hathaway, she's set. She can do what she wants. Song One is her first, major role since she won the Oscar. And it's a nice little story. And it's the sort of movie that it's not going to work as well as a big budget film. It needs to be a small budget film because it needs to be quiet and intimate. Characters like you've got characters that are worth playing, and they're gonna try for it. So
Well, you've also seen all the documentaries as well?
So. Most of them. Still got a few to go.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the highlights there.
The best movie I've seen at the festival is E-Team. Excellent documentary. The sort of combination of the of political immediacy and personal stories following the members of the Human Rights Watch, their emergency team. And these are the folks that go into war zones while the war is still going on, so they can document and bear witness to human rights violations. And it shows them going into Syria during the Civil War, Libya during the Civil War. Shows them going into Syria just last year, just very recently, and getting the word out about atrocities that are happening in countries around the world. It's just really powerful stuff, and it really makes the political very personal.
So best of the fest.
Best thing I've seen all around, yeah.
Now, does it have a chance to go? I mean, obviously they've got a good string going with Oscar nominees with Searching for Sugarman and this year's 20 Feet from Stardom. Is E-Team going to be 2014's,
It depends. It depends on how it plays. It depends on where it gets out. How it gets shortlisted. There are, you look at the five Oscar nominations that this year, I mean, four of them were here last year. But you had, 20 Feet from Stardom and Dirty Wars and so on. You didn't have a nomination for Blackfish, which a lot of people thought was, a strong contender for that. So, which also played here last year. The Oscars will do what they're going to do. It's kind of hard to predict this early on which documentaries are going to make it through the sifting process.
Well, like Blackfish, CNN already picked up Dinosaur 13 this year. Mm-hmm. What have you seen in terms of that you think will have that broader mass appeal this year?
Watchers of the Sky, I'm trying to remember which ones I saw already CNN already came in with Private Violence, the documentary about domestic abuse.
And I think The Battered Bastards of Baseball, too.
I can't remember if that's CNN or HBO. Mm. I haven't seen that one yet. HBO has a couple of them here. They have Captivated, excellent film about the Pamela Smart murder trial and the sensationalism and how the media... what the media's role was in the sensationalizing of that story. And HBO also has The Case Against Eight, the great and for Utah, very timely documentary about the fight against Prop 8 in California, the gay marriage ban.
So you watch a movie and then you come right out and start typing your review? Or did you kind of process it and then finish it later in the evening or – next day, or
you sort of have to do them quick because otherwise they'll log jam. They'll pile up. It would be nice to be able to think more about them, but the conditions don't necessarily permit that. One trick I'll do is I'll use my time on the bus getting to the next place as my time to think, and then when I land and I'm sitting in line for 20 minutes, I can whip out the laptop and then I'll get it written there. So.
All right. Well, people can see all of the ones you've written so far, sltrib.com. Mm-hmm. Good luck today.
Thank you.
With the last four. And thanks so much for spending some time with us this morning.
Happy to be here.
Sean Means, again, is the film critic for the Salt Lake Tribune. KPCW News Time now, 9:24.
Jeff Ross, a.k.a. the Roastmaster General, is known for his body and scathing remarks on 10 Comedy Central roasts of B-list celebrities. And now he's coming to roast you, Park City. He'll take the stage Thursday through Saturday nights, February 6th through 8th at the Egyptian Theater. And so can you. Volunteers with a strong sense of humor will be welcomed. Tickets start at just $39 and are available at parkcityshows.com or at the box office. This show is strongly suggested for mature audiences. The Egyptian Theater is a hilariously nonprofit organization.
Park City Realty Group is a proud sponsor of KPCW's Mountain Money. This is Mike Mazzoni, principal broker and owner of Park City Realty Group. 100% locally owned and operated, Park City Realty Group provides boutique real estate services to buyers and sellers in the area. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Thank you.
Well, every film has a producer and an executive producer, and a name you'll see often in Sundance Films is Geralyn Dreyfuss. She's the co-founder of Impact Partners, as well as the founder of the Utah Film Center. She joins us now in the studio. Good morning, Geralyn.
Good morning, Leslie.
So as executive producer, is it just a role of funding the film, or as a producer gives you kind of more of a hands-on?
Well, at Impact, Dan Kogan and I, my partner, we try to executive produce each of the films that we finance. So one of us is sort of more hands-on than the other. And it is about bringing resources to the table, but it's also about troubleshooting. It's also about late-night coaching just helping put the most creative team of people and ideas together for the film.
Yeah. So how many films did Impact bring to Sundance?
We have 5 films here this year.
And that's about average for you, right?
Well, I could hardly say that, but last year we had about the same. I mean, we were lucky to have as many films this year.
Yeah. Can you tell us which ones those are?
Sure. So we have Web Junkies in the World Doc competition, and then we have E-Team, which I just heard you plugging, which was exciting to hear on the radio.
Right. John says best one of the fast.
I know. Yeah. I'm so excited to hear that. Well, that's Ross Kaufman and Katie Chivanche, and Ross and I came here 10 years ago with Born into Brothels. That was our first Sundance film, so it's kind of exciting to be back with him and a new team and the E-Team. And then we have Alive Inside, which is just thrilling. It's just, I think, blowing audiences' minds right now. Just a very emotional, beautiful film about Alzheimer's and music and memory. Overnighters, which is Jesse Moss's film, beautiful, poignant film. And we had our first feature film this year called Land Ho, which we just sold to Sony Picture Classics. So that's a game changer film, not an impact film. So, but we're working the streets on all of them.
Yeah, and that was what I kind of think, because it seems like you do mostly documentary films, and that doesn't have the return on the investment like a blockbuster would. So,
right.
I mean, how do you manage that?
And you used 2 different terms there, I think, probably very intentionally in terms of impact film versus game changer. Talk about that a little bit in terms of what's the difference.
So Game Changer was a fund that we started. It's our first film as Land Ho. We really started it after misrepresentation in Gina Davis's research that looked at 6% of the movies in Hollywood being directed by women. And we thought, that doesn't seem right. You know, and what we really wanted to look at, what is the cost and authenticity and diversity and discovery? Even parody is one thing, but we also just wanted to look at sort of voice and where original stories come from. So Land Ho is all of that. It's a young director. It's a very smart, authentic, original script. And it played really well for audiences here. So we sold it to Sony Picture Classics at a nice return. And in the feature business, you really have to have a slate of films in order to kind of make money and assess your risk. Whereas in the documentary business, there's still enough broadcast outlets that you can do one-offs so that our investors can actually choose the films that they want to invest in. We bring them a couple of films every 6 weeks that we think are going to be commercially and artistically and successful, as well as have a big social impact. So on the documentary side, we tend to break even for our investors and just return the money so they can get into another film, whereas in the game-changing slate, we're hoping to actually prove that women directors are not only viable but very commercially successful. So it's a different lens that we're applying. Our social lens is women.
So when you decide to help fund a film, I mean, do you have a certain list of requirements that people have? I mean, that you require of them?
Yeah, I mean, filmmakers, we look at 500 films a year, and we're always looking at, you know, the artistic merit of the film. Like, how is this story being told? Has it been told? Does it have a commercial outlet? You know, does it have an audience? Has it been told before? And will it make a difference? And how will it make a difference? So those are the criteria that we look at when we're looking at our documentary slate.
Mm-hmm. Now, with like the Alive Inside, that was one of those that I did get to see. And it's just this Dan, you know, just this guy off the street trying to help people through music. And I don't really know how he did it other than he turned on a recording one day and saw the reaction to somebody. Where would that film go? I mean, they talked about, you know, getting it to distribution, you know, so that everyone can see and start making their playlists for their folks and things like that. But right. I mean, where does that go?
Well, you know, we've had some interest in broadcasters and mm-hmm. theatrical outlets. I think it's a movie that plays very well. It's a very emotionally. It works on so many levels. Both everybody has somebody that's aging, that and dementia is an issue that we all worry about as we grow, as we're aging longer. But it's also a film that really touches you deeply because of music, and it reminds us of how music is so encoded in our memory and in our kind of emotional intelligence. I mean, it plays, I think, on both spectrums. And I think the idea is that if music really can have this impact, why wouldn't we want music? Why wouldn't we want an iPod to be reimbursable the way a cane is, right? Like, why wouldn't that be something that we bring to the mix in our medical care, especially if it is cheaper than antidepressants and drugs that are making people drool, right? I mean, that seems like a more civilized way to enrich and enhance an older person's life.
So can Impact Partners take that then one step and somehow raise the funding for the iPods that are needed?
Well, we're doing that. I mean, we actually had a screening with community leaders, and we had $100,000 pledge we've actually had meetings with the local business here that makes headsets that we were trying to get them to become part of it, you know, and we also want to do a screening for Senator Hatch, who's on the Health and Human Services Committee, and his particular interest is aging and senior care. So, I mean, that's what's so great about Sundance, is that you have a film and then immediately you see this algorithmic, you know, launch into the world just because of the people that are here and the people that can make a difference and connect the dots.
Yeah. So, like with Alive Inside, you know, we've got kind of an issue-oriented. Overnighters, on the other hand, is just something that you watch and see unfold. So where's the future for something like that film?
Well, we've had some offers on a theatrical release of that film. I mean, that is just an astonishingly intimate, quiet, observational film. I mean, to me, it plays like a novel, right? It plays like a it's just an epic story of what happens in a small town, you know, when people descend upon it, and there's in the fear around some people that are different and people that might not be like them, and what gets confronted in a church. It's a very American story. I think a very, kind of a classically American story.
Yeah. And in terms of like Land Ho, you think that will actually have some theatrical release later?
Well, it was bought by Sony Picture Classics, okay, so it's actually on its way to come out in the world at some point. We don't have the dates that it will be out into theaters, but it was bought. So it was a big sale, and it was a huge victory for a small indie film.
Yeah. And there continues to be a lot of internet chatter, I think, on the panel discussion earlier this year. I think it was like Spielberg and Lucas who went off about how hard it is to get access to theaters for the smaller pictures. And invariably, you always hear that every year and year. It's getting harder, harder, harder. You know, is the sky falling, or, you know, are you an optimist in terms of these additional outlets, not only broaden the access points for the fans of these films or viewers of these films, but is it marketable as well in terms of can you... You know, I mean, obviously that's the world you live in, but in terms of, I mean, are you an optimist moving forward or?
I think theatricals are changing. I mean, what we do at the Utah Film Center, I think, really is the future of how people are going to see films. I don't think we're going to see booking films, you know, for weeks at a time, 5 days, five times a day. I think you really have to curate the content you're bringing to theaters, and, you know, smaller films might come in for 3 days, but they might come in with a subject of the film or a conversation built around the film. And I think audiences really need to have more of a reason to come to our theaters, and they have to be salons, and they have to be town halls. They have to be places where people gather so that they can exchange ideas, and it's more interactive than passive, because you can get content anytime you want now. So, you know, there really has to be a reason why you show up at a theater. And a big screen is a great reason, and so is a great sound system, and so is good popcorn. But also the kind of connective tissue around finding your community and being in a culture of people that love ideas or want to discover something. And then that sharing, I think, is what you, the culture you need to build in the theaters to make them stay relevant.
So the Focus Film District merger isn't necessarily doom and gloom, like IndieWire, I think, called it the art house vending machine might be the result or something like that. I think the perspective is that hopefully the theaters continue to book perhaps at shorter runs, but recognize the marketability of the broader film palette, if you will, that will keep a larger segment.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think the theater's job is to grow audiences. That's what we need. It's just the same way the symphony's job is to grow audiences, right? Or the ballet's job. It's their job to get people into their theater. They're competing with a lot of things. And you do that, I think, by making the content accessible and but also kind of reaching out and finding your natural constituents, which I don't think theaters have ever had to do. They've just relied on sort of advertising. And we don't have that. You know, thank God we have a film critic like Sean Means. But, you know, we're losing a lot of channels that sort of help people understand why they want to come see something that might not have a lot of marketing dollars behind it. So we're having to use, you know, deploy a lot of new strategies to get people to still pay attention to the work that's being done.
So what are you working on now in terms of some films?
Well, the two films I'm most excited about that I'm executive producing, one is about the first woman director. It's set in the 1890s. It's Alice Guy Blanchet, and it was a Kickstarter sensation, a director by the name of Pam Green. And it is really telling the history of cinema, but it's doing it through sort of a detective way. She's discovered films. She's restored some of her silent films. And this is a woman that was so ahead of her times. I mean, she really had ideas like Skype and Netflix in addition to sort of the moving picture. So it's going to be fun to kind of reclaim her voice and her place in history. And then the other film that I'm most excited about is called Sounds of Satchel, which is a Pakistani woman director who did Saving Face, won an Academy Award for Saving Face. And it's really about the history of jazz in Pakistan and how it went underground. So it's sort of a Buena Vista Club meets reading Lolita in Tehran. It's just going to be gorgeous. And my dream is that it comes to a big festival and the screen goes up, the curtains open, and it's live jazz for the first 20 minutes. And then the film is shown after that with that. But that's also another film that's gone viral with Kickstarter. They did a version of Take Five with Dave Brubeck when Dave Brubeck passed, and 10 million people heard it. And so Quincy Jones and Winston Marsalis have kind of rediscovered this underground jazz group. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful film. So we're hoping to have that next year here or at some major festival.
Yeah. And real quick, I mean, the Utah Film Center, I mean, I've never been. What do you guys do there?
So we bring films year-round, and we bring the filmmakers the stories behind them. And we do a lot of outreach with nonprofits that have natural connections to the content that we bring. And we also bring a lot of new audiences, and we bring the films to schools. And it's really an opportunity to sort of think about the creation of good storytelling, and it's driven by media literacy as well as by really great storytelling.
And you have two films with Tumbleweeds trying to appeal to children this year's festival, so that's a great new partnership. Has that worked well?
It's been so exciting. Patrick Hubley's had the vision for this idea for years, and I really feel like with Sundance giving it a dedicated platform, children's storytelling or family storytelling will, and the great stories from different parts of the world, our American audiences will get a chance to be exposed to great stories from around the world in a way that they never have before. And they've kind of been the neglected stepchild of festivals. And now I think that there's a chance that people will see how great these films are for families.
Right. Well, Geraldine, thanks for spending some time with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for having us.
Geraldine Dreyfuss is the founder of the Utah Film Center, also co-founder of Impact Partners. KPCW News Time now, 9:40.
Welcome back to the Groovy Pledge Drive of Love Game, round two, the challenge round. I'm your host, Grant Wishes. Larry Warren has the next question.
What are the five locally produced award-winning public affairs shows weekday mornings at 9?
I start listening when the radio alarm goes off, but that darn snooze button gets me every time.
That's okay. You can hear the podcasts, Mountain Money, This Green Earth, The Mountain Life, Cool Science Radio, and Fun Friday online at your convenience. Support these podcasts by pledging
the week of February 10th through the 14th.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher along with Mark Harrington. Well, as the first fully televised court case, the Pamela Smart trial, was just the beginnings of reality TV as we know about it. In the studio with us, the director of Captivated, the trials of Pamela Smart, I've got Jeremiah Zager. Good morning, Jeremiah.
Good morning.
So begin just by telling us, if you would, the background. I mean, give us the setting here of Pamela Smart and why she went to trial.
Well, it's New Hampshire. It's the very, very early 90s. Cable television is exploding for the first time. Court TV has just come into existence. And there's a young woman who is accused of plotting to kill her husband by seducing and coercing three teenage boys, specifically one. And at first, her crime is but a blip on local news, and then it becomes suddenly, you know, tri-state area, and then national, and then worldwide. And it explodes, and it becomes the case that is so infamous today because there's films made about it. Murder in New Hampshire becomes, you know, one of the first ripped from the headlines. TV movies and To Die For, which we all know, the Gus Van Sant film, becomes, you know, a milestone in cinema. I think it played here at the Sundance Film Festival. And I might be wrong about that. And when you look back at the trial, you start to see that the seed for that trial that the media planted became problematic in her getting a fair shake from our justice system.
So at what point then did you decide, I want to go back and look at something? I mean, at this point, you know, it's 90s, you know, I mean, almost 20 years ago.
It wasn't my decision. Yeah. I had just finished In a Dream, and Geraldine, who you just had on, was the executive producer, like I was saying, mm-hmm. and it was a big success, and HBO bought it. And Lori, who's the incredible producer of this film, had the idea for Captivated because she had spoken to a woman who knew Pamela Smart. And was an advocate for her. And the woman that woman, Eleanor Pam, described to Lori was very different from the character in To Die For, and that sparked Lori's interest. And she began to do a massive amount of research way before I even came on with her team, Gabriel Sedgwick and Stacy. And they built a archive of footage that she then gave me to look at because my job at the time was editing movie trailers. And so I cut the movie trailer together and then she saw In a Dream and she said, why don't you direct this film? And by that point, because I had looked at all that footage, I was totally fascinated as well. And we embarked on what, you know, has become a 4-year journey to finish this movie.
Wow. So Pamela Smart is convicted. What about the three kids? Were they?
Two of them are out. Hmm. So they all cut deals. Mm. And at first, she wasn't even mentioned in their confessions. But on the second round, she was. And she became the focus of the case. And they cut deals. And two of them are out. And two will probably get out next year. Now, these are young people who, you know, the physical evidence matches. They walked into a house. They shot a man in the head. And they admitted to it. However, Pamela Smart has life without the possibility of parole, which Charles Manson doesn't even has. She will, you know, never get out of prison unless the governor of New Hampshire intervenes. Not even the president of the United States can get her out of prison.
Hmm. So the film, based on what I've read, just isn't documenting the case, but really an attempt to show how the media can create this kind of skewed view of reality. I mean, what did you see that made you think that something's not right here?
Well, I mean, as you know, we are the media, you know, mm-hmm. and we have this incredible ability to change people's perception of reality, depending on what we say and how we say it and where we cut and what we show. And for me, that was the really interesting thing about this case, because I'm not a lawyer and I don't even like true crime that much, but I love storytelling. And I became fascinated with the courtroom as theater and how that theater translates to television and how that television translates to people's perception of reality. And it's problematic when you're looking at justice. I mean, anybody, you and I included, right? We understand how stories are malleable, how easy it is to simplify them, how easy it is to take out the gray and make things black or white, guilty or innocent, and to lose that nuance, especially when it's compartmentalized, especially when we take a story that deserves, you know, 2-3 hours and we break it down to, you know, 15-second sound bites to hold an audience's attention, and we make it as salacious and as gratuitous as possible. You know, what happens when someone's humanity is lost in that? And what happens when somebody's life is lost in that? Not only, you know, their guilt or innocence, but, you know, their very base person. I mean, that's problematic, I think.
Mm-hmm. Again, but the whole trial, I mean, wasn't it gavel-to-gavel coverage on TV? So people really did have an opportunity to see the whole picture, unlike, you know, a newscast.
Sure, but it's how, you know, most people didn't watch the whole trial all the way through. Most people watched the recap. I mean, that's really the case. And also there was commentary in between. So you might be watching something, but then, you know, it's the commentators that really synthesize it for the audience. So it's you know, it's both. But then the lens is problematic too. We don't think about the lens, but when someone is being watched, they change. You know, we talk about, you know, a very easy way to understand it is we talk about how some people are photogenic or not photogenic. You know, you look at somebody and you say, oh, that's a really handsome person or a really beautiful person. But on camera, you don't see that. Well, that's a very, very easy way to understand how the lens can change what we perceive as reality when we're looking at it without the lens. And so even that changes justice, I think, and is a really, really, you know, potent, simple argument for why cameras shouldn't be allowed in a courtroom.
Well, I agree completely in terms of the sense of how the action and the perceptions change because of the camera. But doesn't the case really come down to whether the jurors themselves were properly sequestered and isolated from that? And
exactly.
And as I understood the case, the linchpin evidence was whether you find that the tapes are authentic or not, right? Because she's
absolutely.
So
the jury was not sequestered, which is fascinating. Mm. So the jury was allowed to watch anything out in the world at the entire time. They weren't sequestered till the very, very last day of the trial. So who knows what they could have seen or didn't see? That's fascinating.
Because I did read there were several interviews done. I think it was by Oprah that interviewed the jurors after the fact, and they were pretty steadfast that they were isolated from the media, as I understood it, but were shocked by the sentence because they were isolated from the sentencing, and then discovered. So for them, it wasn't an issue of fair trial. It was an issue of fair sentencing, which I think your film focuses on as well.
Absolutely. Well, the disproportionate sentencing is really disturbing. But another thing we look at is, you know, the reality that despite the fact that you may think you've given someone a fair trial, you have no idea because you're not supposed to be influenced. You're not supposed to be able to have those headlines able to read. So whether or not you say, I was not influenced by that, you have no idea because it's pervasive. So and that's why since the Pamela Smart trial, juries have been sequestered systematically when that media is pervasive. For instance, in the Trayvon Martin trial or in the O.J. Simpson case. I mean, it's consistent as we move forward. And a lot of lawyers argue that this case is the beginning of why we need to sequester juries when the media is so pervasive. And you asked one thing after that, right? You said you were talking about her sentence.
Yes.
Well, her sentence is just insane. Yeah.
So she doesn't have grounds for appeal then?
No. So the problem is that you appeal to the same judge who convicted you. So her first appeal, you know, that judge has to say, I made a mistake. And that judge was not willing to say he made a mistake. And then because the media was so vitriol, the next set of appeals was politically untenable. Like you couldn't give Pamela Smart another chance in New Hampshire because everyone in New Hampshire was convinced that she was a poison, something that, you know, was an infectation that would destroy, you know, young people across the state.
So your film somewhat sympathizes with Pamela, and is that the reason that you say that you wouldn't show the film in New Hampshire at one of your Q&As?
Be happy. I did not say that. I mean, I'm happy to show the film
in
New Hampshire.
Going back there.
I was sort of teasing. I mean, New Hampshire's a wonderful place. I think I took that out. That's taken out of context. But when you're investigating something that's so horrendous in any state that, you know, the surroundings become oppressive. And for me, that was, you know, talking to people who were involved in a murder, everything became scary. And I think people are afraid in that state. Many people are afraid to talk about how egregious the system of that trial became. And so when you do talk to them about it, they, you know, they whisper, and, you know, we couldn't get a lot of people on tape because, you know, it's still a very sore subject.
So have we come full circle? The irony of this whole story is, of course, she started at the time the story begins. She's in media, and now you're using media to advocate, perhaps.
This is
not using, but, you know, there. But media is her only opportunity, perhaps, for renewed consideration.
She believes that. I mean, this is not an advocacy film. This is a film that's asking us as an audience, how are we complicit, and why is this a problem? We're not just saying Pam Smart got a shitty trial and therefore she should be free. We're saying, what if you were in that chair? How would you feel? What is wrong with this system? There's a moment where Alec Beckett, the juror who you mentioned, who says, you know, he wasn't influenced, says in accordance with her sentence, you know, she got a horrible, horrible sentence, but the system did what the system does. And I find that so problematic. When we start to allow the system to do terrible things, we become complicit in that system. And I just think that's wrong.
I need to leave it at that. But Jeremiah, sounds fascinating. You've got one more screening here at the Egyptian Theater tonight. That starts at 6 o'clock. Good luck to you, and thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
KPCW News Time, now 9:53.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Screening in this year's next category, the film Drunk Town's Finest, is director Sydney Freeland's first feature film. She joins us now in the studio. Good morning, Sydney, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So tell, what is Drunk Town's Finest it's about? It's part of the like I mentioned, the next category, which is usually reserved for competition-type films with a lower budget.
Yeah, I believe so. You know, it's a coming-of-age story about three different characters who represent three different genders, you know, a male, a female, and a transgender character. And it just so happens that they are all Native American, and it takes place on an Indian reservation.
All right. So why your interest in this? I mean, is it writing from personal experience or?
Yeah, you know, I'm Native American myself. I was born and raised on the reservation. And, you know, I wanted to tell a story, you know, about the people and the places that I knew growing up. And then also show how diverse the reservation is, you know. And so part of the reason of these three characters was to show, you know, they represent three very different communities, and you get to see how they all interact and intersect with each other.
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, there aren't many films with Native Americans as lead characters. So in terms of the eventual, I mean, I guess as a filmmaker, you would say it doesn't matter what nationality they are. It's a story regardless. But does that make it difficult, though, for you to, you know, to find audiences for it?
Yeah, you know, like, you know, again, like going into it, it was, you know, it was just about sort of wanting to tell the best possible story that we could tell, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there are specifics, you know, about the film. You know, it's a Native American, you know, centered story. There's 36 speaking roles in the film. 32 of them are Native American, which worked out really nicely. And 18 of those are specifically Navajo, which is the tribe represented in the film. But it was important for me to cast Native actors, and like specifically people who were sort of familiar with the reservation, because they had to bring a certain dynamic to the film. Like, you know, it had to be grounded in a sort of sense of reality. You know, I didn't want like central casting coming out from Santa Monica and pretending that they were born and raised on the reservation. So,
yeah, was that a challenge though, to get permission to film on the reservation, or because you're a resident, it's not a big deal?
No, it was actually, there was some concern that it would be very challenging. But, you know, I work in the film industry in L.A. And, you know, it's funny, like you go to L.A. and you knock on someone's door and ask to shoot on their front lawn. And, you know, people are very jaded, you know, and they'll pull out a contract and say, you know, okay, I need this, this and this, and I need all this other stuff. You know, you go on the reservation, knock on someone's door and like, hey, do you mind if we shoot in your front yard? And then they make you lunch, you know. So everyone was very open and very receptive.
Yeah. So was this home for you? I mean, this is where you grew up, was where you filmed, or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We actually shot in my hometown of Gallup, New Mexico.
Okay. So you knew some of the characters then? I mean, hired, I guess, some of the actors?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I've been gone for like 10 years. So you know, we did some open casting calls in Gallup, in Santa Fe, in Albuquerque. We shot the whole film in New Mexico, Gallup, Española, and Santa Fe. We got a lot of local talent. You know, I was really happy how that worked out.
And talk a little bit about the title, because I know, you know, I don't know if you've seen the Amish film, Devil's Playground, but I'm pretty sure that that title didn't go over so well initially with the Amish community and obviously with Drunktown Finest. Did you run into opposition with that, or what is the meaning behind the title?
So, you know, the title has a lot of personal meaning for me. You know, I was born and raised in Gallup, and Gallup is a border town to the Navajo Reservation. And so in the late 80s, early 90s, it sort of became notorious for these high rates of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And, I was only in elementary school at the time. And I remember like 2020, the ABC show 2020 came and did a segment called Drunktown USA. And, you know, like I said, I was in elementary school, but I was like, why is this like big film crew coming from L.A. and they're just like filming the drunks? You know, like they should go to like my auntie's house and go film her because she's like kind of awesome, you know.
That's great.
And so that was, you know, once I started writing the script, you know, and once I left the reservation, I sort of realized how kind of like severe the situation was. But once I started writing the story and everything, I kept going back to that. So that was sort of the genesis of the story, was to like try to take these three characters and just drop them into a similar environment and have them trying to sort of escape it.
Yeah. I noticed in some of the notes here that you actually participated in the Sundance Institute Native American Lab. Was it for this film back in 2009?
Yes. I participated in the Native Lab, which is run by Bird Running Water. Who is a large, you know, he's a big reason why this film got made, along with our producer, Chad Burris. And then I did the Screenwriters Lab, the Directors Lab, the Composers Lab, and the Producer Summit.
Wow.
Yeah, so all with Drunktown, yes.
Oh, well, good. So it was kind of like took the village to help make the movie there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the what the story was going into the labs and coming out is, you know, 180 degrees.
Wow. Well, congratulations to you. You've got a final screening again tonight as well. That's happening at 5:30 p.m. at the Prospector Square Theater. The best of luck to you. Again, that's the Sydney Freeland. She's the director of the film Drunktown's Finest. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
good arrangement.
And that's a wrap for this year's Sundance Reel. A big thank you to all of my co-hosts, including you, Mark. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
This is KPCW Park City. It's 10 o'clock. Time for news.